I asked the students to send me some quotes for tonight's program on your other side. Several of them responded very quickly, and each of their suggestions speaks to a kind of devotion. Writing is a serious enterprise, a serious responsibility, and a serious joy. These 10 writers have taken it up for real. At this time of year, when we're doing MFA admissions at the same time that we're sending off a fresh crop of finished writers, apparently, I have cause to think about the many things that make our program special. And the thing that strikes me this time around is that our program allows each person to have the MFA experience that he or she wants and needs. Teaching, of course, Cheat River, maybe, COW, lots of out-of-genre workshops, or just the one, basketball or no basketball, time with peers or a more solitary approach. There are many ways to do the program, just as there are many writers here tonight. And each way has, I'm confident, worked just perfectly. You've written the stories and essays and poems you've needed to write. We've been happy to keep you company along the way. So Maggie, Emily, Melissa, Haley, Claire, Marianne, Fagan, Barrett, Travis, Sean, thank you for sharing your seriousness of purpose with us, your devotion to the craft of writing. You have enlivened our workshops and our community of writers. You have reminded us in ways big and small why we undertake this difficult craft and how much pleasure we gain from the pursuit. All right, I'm going to turn it over now to thesis directors, and per usual, we'll go through the list and the director will come up and do an introduction, and then the writer will come up and get hooded in an ancient and inexplicable ceremony that we do very badly, and then the writer will read with the hood on. Which is interesting to watch. Thank you so much.
Ferone's memoir, Look Alive, there's a great deal of loss before there is any found. Innocence, her girlhood, and for a terrifying while, her very identity. Sometimes you open to a knock and evil comes striding through the door. This happens. It happened to Melissa. That man left by the door, he came in, but he haunted Melissa's consciousness as real, returning for months, then years, in terrifying flashbacks. Look Alive is not a recovery memoir. It's about trying to swim in the wake of extreme trauma. Finally, it's about life-saving. What Look Alive insists on is that Melissa made it to shore and emerged heart whole and an extraordinary writer. So please welcome Melissa.
I'm sure I'm not going to be the only person tonight who struggled to find the right way to say thank you to everyone, so I'm going to be really brief so I don't mess it up. I wanted to thank the department and all of the brilliant writers I've worked under and all the inspiring writers I've worked beside, and thank you to Kevin, whose guidance and influence has truly been indescribable. Now my bruises are sky blue, moss green. My welts have diminished, my scrapes scabbed over. I haven't had an appetite. I've been relying on bourbon to nurse me. My hair is falling out. I am molting. Summer's foul breath still clings here, wafting over the West Virginia mountainside in thick currents. The earth, cracked and dusty, dead skin tan. Bugs everywhere. The heat has overstayed its welcome, stolen autumn's slow reveal and burned up the trees. Wilted and browned, they drop their leaves on the simmering asphalt. By the time Appalachia cools, there will be none left to redden or gild, except for the sweet gums, who remain resolute in their emerald plumage, overlooking campus from atop their hill. star-leafed sweet gums, each leaf a North Star. I watch them through Tommy's open bedroom window. They wave, I wave. I wonder how high the strongest branch is, if it could hold my weight, if I could find rope and tie a noose. It is steaming, and I sweat until my scabs itch, until I peel them off one by one, toss them over the windowsill with a wish. I am always hurting. The scratches fester and scar between my legs, and always a pink blooming of urine on the toilet, the blood boulder on the rim. I have cramps and headaches, my arms throb. I have not yet had my period, and my rapist's semen was found in the condom and on the bed sheets and inside me. And that first morning after the rape, I'd scraped some off my face and chest. Why did I let a boy into my room? I should have known better, I think, over and over. Somehow in my mind, where loneliness and loss swirl into a great maelstrom of self-doubt, that was reason enough. I should have known better. So I was raped. The sweet gums are still waving, and the sky is graying, and perhaps there will be rain. My rapist is walking around out there, somewhere, beyond this window. He is more human than me. He has a past he remembers, and friends, a mother who calls on the weekends and tells him she loves him. I know, because he stalks me, texts me, tells me everything. Sometimes he sends me pictures of beautiful girls smiling on his bed. Then, the next day, he sends me pictures of their panties. He calls and leaves voicemails. He wants to know where I am. He wants to stop by. He wants to finish what he started. Just kill yourself, one voicemail said, and a group of boys cackled and cheered in the background. As a girl, the boys at school called mine a lock and theirs a key, as if their hardness could unhinge me, open me up to plunder. So I've taped my own panties to my body, duct tape wrapped around my hips until half the roll is gone. My skin swells at the edges. I am bursting at the seams. Tommy cuts it loose. There is relief in the coldness of the scissors' blades, and I imagine them puncturing me, releasing all the pressure building there. When I'm cut free, I stumble drunk to the shower to scrub the sticky residue off my now pink hips. I hate this body. It isn't mine, I swear. I'm not at home in these limbs, in this mess of woven cells, this contraption of follicles and tendons and viscera. Under the hot water, I scrub this body raw, wanting to peel away all the dry, cracked layers, wanting to shed to the bone all the skin my rapist touched. My body is a home that is not mine, a home ravaged by house fire. I'm living in the shell among the charred beams and blazing floors. The wall beneath the windows has fallen through to the ground, so many blackened, gaping holes. Anyone could get in now. Thank you.
Paravani, who was her thesis director. And this is the intro that Krista wrote. Marianne Hudak's thesis, entitled Don't Disturb the Growing Grass, is an ode to introversion. It's a collection that posits whether writing is similar to listening. Marianne isn't shy. She's an astute observer, and because of this gift, her small moments are profound. As she turns inward quietly, the rain and the night and the first days preparing a meal alone in a new home are lifted. Marianne crafts small moments into prayers. This collection is a surprising mix of Marianne's devotions: religion, suburban Ohio, China, anxiety, sisterly love, leaving. Again and again, she writes as if praying, a mode that she crafts with unrelenting reason, a weaving of the academic and the personal. Marianne says, prayer, like sound, travels best through water. Within these pages, she brings the reader underwater with her to a place that is bravely unobtrusive and profoundly clear beneath the waves. Please welcome Marianne Hudak.
Thank you. I'm going to be reading this excerpt from an essay that is about beets and also about tomatoes. So this is a tomato section. I looked up from the book I was reading and glanced at the clock. It was 12:45, which meant Mom would be home from work in a half hour. It was time to start making lunch. I set my book down on our family room end table and eased my arm from beneath our sleeping dog. Mom had picked some cherry tomatoes before she left for work that morning. I grabbed two generous handfuls from the colander, diced them, and put them in a pan with a little water and oil. I turned the knob of the gas burner to a low setting so the tomatoes would cook down into a sweet sauce. Next, I cut some spinach, garlic, and basil, and added them to the pan of tomatoes now sizzling. Our dog jumped off the couch and shook off the remnants of her early afternoon dreams. Her nails clicked against the linoleum floor of the foyer to her padded lookout at the front window. She knew the smell of simmering tomatoes meant Mom would be home soon. In two bowls, I portioned out our servings of egg noodles and ladled some of the sauce on top. It was a concoction I called the tomato dish, one of the few things I had mastered in the kitchen. My culinary skills can be more accurately described as combining rather than cooking. I took whatever was on hand and combined it into something new. During the summer and early fall, the tomato plants along the back of the house ripened faster than we could eat them, thriving in the sunlight on their south-facing stretch of dirt. I invented the tomato dish as a practical solution to the tomato-laden limbs. My sisters didn't like the tomato dish. My youngest sister complained that the skins were too chewy, and my middle sister said the smell made her nauseous. I had to open a window if I prepared it while she was in the house. Dad would eat it, but only as a side dish. Mom was my biggest enthusiast. We ate it each weekday afternoon for lunch. I heard our dog start barking, which meant she recognized Mom's van pulling up the driveway. Just in time, lunch was ready. I love that smell, Mom said as she opened the front door. Toto does too. She knew you were on your way. I set the table and waited for Mom to put away her whistle and lanyard, with the blue and pink bathroom passes clipped along the sides. For almost 10 years, she's worked as a lunch and recess monitor at the local elementary school that my sisters and I once attended, and that my dad had also attended when he first moved here as a child. Mom joined me at the table, and as we ate, she told me about the kids who hadn't listened that day and the co-workers who had called off again. Outside the window, the cherry tomato plants continued to grow up the side of the house, stems heavy with what would be our lunches for this week and the next. You don't know how nice it is to come home to a warm meal, Mom said, taking the last few bites. But I do, I said. While I was growing up, Mom always had dinner ready as soon as I got home from an after-school club meeting or when I took a break from studying. If the recipe called for mushrooms, she left them out of my portion. And when we had green beans, she gave me extra. Throughout my life, she served each meal with an implied, I love you. By the time I graduated college and moved back home, I felt like a child in many ways. I was still learning to be self-sufficient, but I had learned just enough about cooking that I could say, I love you too. The lunch table represented a changing of guards. It was the 15 minutes of our weekday afternoon schedules that overlapped. Her workday was done, and mine was just beginning. I needed to help set up for an after-school program at the local Creative Writing Center. There were materials to prepare and snacks to portion out before the kids arrived. I should probably go to work, I said, savoring such grown-up sounding words, as well as the lingering aftertaste of a meal I'd prepared. In that moment, I felt happy, not only to be Mom's daughter, but to be her adult daughter. I went up to my room to change into my work clothes, then came back downstairs to gather my things. By then, I knew Mom had taken her glasses off and was curled up on the couch next to our dog for an afternoon nap. Her eyes were probably closed as she rattled off the last few reminders. When I get to work, make sure I close the car windows since it might rain. And when I come home, pull in on the left side of the driveway so Dad could leave for choir practice. She punctuated her list with a final, "I love you." "I love you too." By the time I returned home, I knew she would have a warm dinner ready.
Sean Turner's fiction, that I feel as though I'm inside the fever dream of an old soul, a wise and worn poet from a bygone era. Perhaps this is fitting, for Sean wrote as the very first sentence of the critical preface to his thesis the following: "Even before I had written words, I felt my world as a story." I am grateful that he felt his world as such, for here is a young writer who has listened and listened well to the old souls in his native Kentucky, a young writer who truly knows how to name every plant and animal and human-made thing around him. Peters County, Kentucky Stories is the collection that emerges from that felt world, and it does so boldly, beautifully. Please welcome Sean Turner.
I just want to say thank you to everyone who's here, everyone who's been a part of, I guess, my journey over this last 3 years. Those of you who are those who aren't here in this room right now, everyone in the program, thank you all so much. I'm reading a selection that I just wrote. It was actually workshopped tonight. So this is an example of the program in practice. So, this isn't my thesis at all, so if it's terrible, just applaud. Marisol bought the butterfly shrub from Rex Ferdinand, the one-eyed garden man who ran his stand off Foxlander Road. She saw it tucked in between two Mother's Day lilies on the old newspaper rack where Rex kept his scant supply of blooms. Maybe Marisol purchased the thing because the flowers were a dracopia of color and shape spliced together so pleasingly. Orange heart-shaped tea roses, whiny bell-bottom pansies, eyeshadow pink Sharon of the Valley. Maybe Marisol considered the unobtrusively tucked vine-like leaves, green as bottle glass and somewhat tacky. Maybe Marisol bent her hands around one of the sweet-smelling and tender blooms, almost cold to the touch. Whatever the reason, Marisol bit red into her bottom lip when she saw the butterfly shrub on Rex's sale rack, planted into a family-sized clip container that Rex had poked with air holes, the plastic still jagged at the bottom like feet. Marisol knew she would buy it to fill a table collecting dust or a gray scare. Marisol had bought food and flowers at the wire and wood framed garden shack during Rex's business hours, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. from March 27th and June 19th, then 9:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. every August 19th, November 19th. But Rex Ferdinand looked old to Marisol that year finally, as if age head fell around his shoulders in the night like a frost. His bald head was still smooth and buff shiny, and his jumpsuit looked as blue as a clean sky. But Rex's stubby jaw lacked a certain firm clench, and the bulb of his nose seemed a bit too red. Rex Ferdinand's ever-present stories of his other life in Florida were a little less wild. Now he played chess and mahjong at the cement tables in St. Petersburg. He told no stories of running his metal detectors up and down the beaches, nor any tips from the annual Horticultural Academy conference he loved and attended every July, all he had talked about the entire year before. The day Marisol bought the butterfly shop from Rex Ferdinand's, Rex sat out front of the shack in between a table of blue and red, styrofoam baskets of cherry and grape tomatoes, some with black fertilizer and green leafy vines still attached. She thought about how she hadn't grown a garden in at least 20 or 30 years since she grew up with her grandmother out past Creech. When Marisol began working as a nurse's aide down at the County Health Center, things just got too busy. But she missed the nostalgia of the garden, had this reoccurring dream of walking out to the garden in the early morning of the summer, picking a ripe red tomato in the dew and eating it outside, wanted to can for the winter like her mama and grandmama and her great-grandmothers before her. She wanted to send her future grandkids home from their Sunday visits with jars of green beans, corn scrubbed off the cob, pickled okra. Marisol turned to Rex and said, "You know, I forgot about the way my great-grandparents used to garden. They looked at the moon before they dug." She felt the rust in her voice, like tears about to come. She ran her hand through her hair. Marisol could remember pieces of it, like some long ago nursery rhyme. They planted potatoes in the feet so they grew big underground. They planted corn in the arms so it spread out tall. Leafy greens turn out best in the heart because they don't rot out and they have strong leaves. "My daddy used to plant by the phases of the moon too," Rex Ferdinand fidgeted, rocking his weight from one foot to the other. "You know," he started. He held the bill of his cap narrow in his palm, his tan skin worked hard to the bone when he pressed the change into Marisol's soft hand. "My pa knew it all by heart, but I keep me an almanac, always hanging on a rusty nail in my barn. Somehow it still tells me what to do."
Many of Travis Mersing's poems take place along a hemlock ridge or in a meadow or beside some morning glories, which is to say they happen in this world. And of course, in the interior world, and in the world of childhood too, once and forever surreal, running beside us, touching us, tag, you're it. In the stop and start of Elegy, in the music of his Appalachian upbringing, Travis has crafted poems of real power and resonance. And Travis is that rare poet whose critical prose is as uncommonly good as his poems. It has been my pleasure to read both for several years now. Travis has written that he wanted to acknowledge the sunset, wanted to say something memorable, and that he has indeed done, time and again. Please welcome Travis Mersing.
Thank you, Marianne, and thank you all for coming. I just have three poems for you here, and the first one, I haven't figured out what to call it, so we'll just call it Untitled. One spring, my young niece tells me she wants to go exploring. We're beside the old barn, and she's really good at picking out deer trails through the leaves and mud and fresh grass. She runs ahead. She teaches me about morels and moss and where the rabbits go when they sleep. Each of her days is a story she creates. There's the special puddle where we wash our boots. There's the clump of moss she slowly places on a rock beside the old barn. How she whispers to it, "There you go." There's her calmness when I point out a dead raccoon. She climbs trees, she bottle feeds lambs. She tells me about a deer walking through a morning fog, how you see it quietly, and how it simply sees you too. Once, between 3 a.m. and dawn, I reached out to touch someone not ever there. The walls, the bedroom walls, dark as if besooted by the candles of a long-neglected temple, built for something close to the light off at Cold Valley Creek. There were walnuts and honey. There were two sprigs of laurel blossoms in a vase on the shrine. A gray parrot paced the garden windowsill. He seemed to understand. I want someone to hold me down and tell me what it feels like to be today. I want to be picked rhythmically by tender hands until I let go some essential sound. At least once, my thoughts have seized a chrome jab of static between the folds of now and now. Thankfully, we are able to continue. Before dawn, I realize I'm carnivorous, that what I desire is what I should carefully fear. The neighboring porch light is razor bright. It scrapes the minutes until they are limp, useless for all else but target practice. Throw the mason jars, dirty. Throw the empty husks of all I think I know. We can pretend they are petals, not snow, in the dim, stone-faced air. Out of the ash. Daybreak, and the mergansers are already couples on the river. Coffee steam, a pleasant absence somewhere I usually can't reach. I stand open to the last crunch of snow, to the curves of a skimmed stone. Who taught me? My brother, a cousin, someone whose voice I haven't heard in months or years. If the air was warmer, or if the sun would just rise above the spruce rim, not finally, but again, I'd crawl out of my shoes and socks, step slow, first through damp, dead grass, then mud, then shock and smile of spring melt water. If I were less hungover, maybe I would. On the cabin porch, the ash bucket spills over again. Though I try to forget, this seems like home. Some part wants to say what was home. All their work unraveling, even with the stitches I tried to learn to make. The kindling stacked, stoked in the fireplace, I begin the last day here, away from most things, just out of focus. There is sustenance, still, somewhere. There is growth from all this, by a fire I still love like a child.
Thank you for being here. It's a great, great crowd, a real tribute to our writers. I feel like throwing my hat in the ring for the Republican nomination. It's not too late, it's a contested convention. Let's do it, people. Ernest Hemingway advised writers to write hard and clear about what hurts. And this is what Haley Foglio does in her novel, Through Battle. Her three young protagonists face a horror show of trauma far beyond what even Flannery O'Connor, no stranger to the horrific, suggested was childhood's bequest to the would-be writer. But Haley's work isn't horror in the genre sense of all chills, no character development. It's memorable, compelling, literary writing about three wounded souls who, in friendship, might be able to overcome what fate has cruelly placed in their paths. I'm delighted to have worked with Haley these past 3 years, and I will miss her. Please welcome Haley.
Every single person in the department, all my friends, everybody, Amanda in particular. But mostly I want to thank my dad, because without my dad, I would be a much lesser person than I am. Yeah. Okay, I'm just going to read the first few pages of my thesis.
Sadie Mae James liked to draw dead bodies, the bones in particular. Once everything else is gone, once the breath has evaporated and the bowels have released, and the flesh and muscle and organs have all sunk back into the ground, the bones are what remain. Sadie has a favorite spot on the banks of the Mississippi River, a place where things are just a little bit quieter, where the world spins a little bit slower, where the leaves of the southern red oaks are so crisp that she can hear them scraping against each other when the wind whispers. It is the place where she can do her art, uninterrupted by her parents, by her homework, by the distraction of the TV, the phone, and the world. She doesn't have to think about how to move her hand to get the perfect curve of a skull, she simply does it. Sometimes she even makes up stories for the bodies she draws, how they died, who their families were, what they liked. She is drawing the bones of a little girl, 10 years old, taken 9 years too soon. When the storms come, filling the holes of New Orleans, filling the creeks, the lakes, the places people wouldn't think needed to be filled, Sadie listens to the river more closely. She sits with her back to it. She can hear the water lap against the mud on the bank, the places where it rushes over the rocks then slows again. Sometimes there is a moment when she wants to go in, to see how bad the undertow really is, to see if she can drown. But her curiosity is quickly overshadowed by the tremors in her fingertips, the tension in her chest. In these moments, she thinks of Lila Jane. Even at 10 years old, Lila Jane, 2 years older than Sadie, was special. When Sadie would wake up crying in the night because of nightmares, because she had to go to the bathroom, because she couldn't fall back asleep, Lila Jane woke up peacefully. Sometimes their mama would come into their bedroom to check on them, and she would find Lila Jane curled up with Sadie, whispering her little sister back into her dreams. Sadie was a picky eater and begged her parents not to make her anything green or brown or any other color she found unpleasant. Lila Jane ate whatever was put in front of her. Sadie's progress reports from school said she needed to focus more and pay attention in class, and Lila Jane got straight A's. Sadie worshipped her. When Lila Jane wanted to go somewhere or do something, Sadie would beg to go with. Beg so hard that her cheeks flamed red, her head pounded, and her skin ached. Lila Jane would just smile and say, "Well, I'd never go anywhere without you." The girls had liked to go outside. They liked the way that the grass pressed on the pads of their toes when they kicked their shoes off, and the thin line of trees that separated their backyard from the great Mississippi, and even the dirty color of the river water itself. Everything that Sadie loves now. They played Princess Rescue, where one sister climbed a tree and pretended to be in a castle guarded by a hulking evil dragon, and the other sister would climb up after her, fighting off the mythic beast with a stick she found on the ground just moments before. Once the princess was rescued, the girl switched roles and started all over again. Lila Jane was always the fiercest warrior. She leapt, stabbed, swung from branches, anything to kill the elusive dragon. Sadie watched in awe at the ways in which her sister's body moved, at the power that Lila Jane possessed. One November morning, after a violent night storm, the Mississippi was deeper than the girls had ever seen it. The water eased up over the arc of the riverbed, softening dirt into mud, stealing away important inches of battleground from the sisters. They didn't mind, though. It was merely another challenge to conquer on the route to the princess's heart. Sadie played the princess first. She climbed the tree in the same way that she always had, pulling herself up branch by branch, reaching into the leaves, into the sky. When she looked down, Lila Jane had already started her fight with the dragon. Sadie got comfortable and watched her sister's spirited battle. During the few seconds that Sadie had chosen to squint her eyes together and rub them with clumsy fingers to get rid of the dirt that had grown scratchy behind her eyelids, Lila Jane slipped. She had not been able to account for the inches they'd lost to the mud. When Sadie opened her eyes again, Lila Jane was face down in the water, a small branch that slid inside her bright yellow sweater, the only thing keeping her body from drifting down the river alongside its sodden debris. Sadie screamed for her sister. She tried to get down out of the tree, but she too slipped and scraped her leg on a branch that she'd forgotten was there. Blood trickled down her knee and her shin where her skin used to be. She looked to Lila Jane for help and then remembered, and then she screamed again. 8 years later, this is the only distance she can handle. her back against the fourth nearest tree to the river, just far enough away to hear the water without seeing it, just close enough to tap into the magic she'd fashioned with Lila Jane. Sadie thinks about her sister's bones, about the size of them, the weight of them, the box they were buried in. When Lila Jane first died, Sadie wanted revenge. True, it was the rock that had broken Lila Jane's head, rendering her unconscious, but it was the water filling her lungs that stopped her breathing. She wanted to make the river pay. She wanted to drain all the water, pierce the riverbed with knives and sticks, proposition her dragon to burn it down. But those thoughts faded with time, and as a teenage girl, she felt pity for the river more than anything else. It didn't know what it had done, what it was responsible for, so she sat and she listened to it, and she drew dead bodies.
Southern women who worked in obituaries was poor Margaret Mitchell. I can see her hidden in the back rooms of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, researching dead folks she didn't know. This was a time when the world clearly did not know what to do with smart women. Fagan's obituaries are not just witty anecdotes about family, but it's an honest look at culture and history. Through them, we experience this place of Appalachia, America, called home. Fagan's writing is just not about obituaries. Her memoir, A Funeral in My Brain, shows us characters that Toni Morrison calls painted with a broad stroke. It has been a pleasure to work with you this year, Fagan. Mm-hmm. I congratulate you. I'm sure Margaret Mitchell would as well. Could you come up, please?
Standing here without him, and he made this essay possible. Okay. Underneath the morning sun at the Memorial Day weekend, my father extended a tape measure across the length of the family plot as he knelt beside Grand's grave. "How tall are you?" he asked, focusing on the reach of the yellow line. "I want to be cremated," I said. I looked down at him, like my mother. "Well, more room for me," he shrugged, proceeding to measure the width of grass between gravestones. In my father's family, they don't think about the physical reality of death. The bodies decay in stages, blood draining, rigor mortis, green fluid seeping from cold flesh, flies laying eggs. Instead, they look toward the sunlit blue of a cloudless sky and imagine a mansion in a heaven somewhere beyond. They believe when the rapture comes, Jesus will descend from the east amid flashes of light and trumpet calls. They bury their dead to face him so they can rise into the hand of God. They bury them whole and on sacred ground with manicured lawns and fences, preserving the remains with embalming fluid so their bodies can be filled with his light when they are lifted from their earthen home. "You know I'm going to hell, so I won't see you again," Aunt Mary used to say between curled lips, smoke drifting out through closed teeth to anyone who walked into her periphery from her constant position at her parents' kitchen table. She spent the last years of her life smoking Winston's and drinking Tab, hair poking out in dark brown straw. She could never articulate why she was so sure of her fate to me, but she once told Aunt Becky she knew she was going to hell because she slept with a black man. She tried to kill herself long before, sometime in her late 20s, in the basement of Grandma Papal's house at 3 a.m. She never had the chance to feel the cool metal of the barrel against her temple because it misfired into the ceiling. Afterward, when she tiptoed through the halls, the bedroom door handles were probably slick with the sweat of her palms as she turned each knob, trying to catch the sound of breathing. Great Aunt Jessie died from ovarian cancer the year before I was born. She spent her last years in Arizona, painting the desert sun in a kaleidoscope of cactus webs, circles of red and orange spreading outward, mirror images from each corner converging toward the center into the shape of a cross. She painted four of these pictures, mandalas, meditations on open sky. She made many copies, and now they hang in my living room, as they hang in every living room of everyone in my mother's family still alive. At Grandma's memorial service, the holes of cicadas crunched under my steps as I walked up the staircase of Westminster Presbyterian. The insects come to Nashville in 13-year cycles, a soft horde emerging from the dirt to calm on a branch before hardening. As Uncle Bobby handed Grandma's ashes to the Reverend to plant in the courtyard's wall, their calls wailed with the contraction of their timbre and alternating clicks of breath. During the Han period, the Chinese carved cicadas out of jade and placed them in the corpse's mouth to aid in reincarnation. They believed our bodies to be a shell and that we return in the next life with a new one, forgetting our previous skin. They believed we should not fear death because we are born again, cicadas flitting through the trees, dancing like wildfires, calling in a constant chorus. When I die, I'd like to be in the desert like Great Aunt Jessie. I'd like the rays of the dry sun to seep into my wrinkles unfiltered, filling me with a burn as slow as the cigars Grandfather smoked in his sunroom. I'd like to only see orange for miles, to bathe in the unfamiliar, a landscape devoid of any grass, clover, or classification of birch or poplar. I don't know at the moment my breath stops if I'll meet God or fade into darkness, but at least I'll die under a mirage of endless light. According to Genesis, before the Great Flood, people lived for hundreds of years. The generations of the sons of Adam and their lifespans and the year of their deaths are recorded in the Bible till the sons of Noah. They all died because they were mortal, except for Enoch, who walked with God, for God took him. Enoch lived one moment and then suddenly he did not, welcomed into the hand of God, welcomed into an everlasting warmth. Enoch was raised above the ranks of men and became one with the angels. He is still with God to this day, enveloped by a choir of song. Sometimes God is not there. In my room at 4 a.m., I turn in wrinkled sheets while my mind ferments rotten memories. When my cheeks are hot and saturated from sweat and tears in the dark, and I can only see the glow of automated red numbers changing from 4 to 5, I look for God's light and cannot find it. But sometimes, when I'm still enough, I can see God in the faces of my family. Framed photographs filling the spaces between the books on my heirloom mahogany shelf. And sometimes I can hear God in the breeze of Kentucky as the wind waves thin stalks of hay in Papaw's field, rolling like the ocean. When I sit on Papaw's front porch, I am quiet enough to look towards that field and imagine a Messiah underneath the lone crabapple tree, the gnarled bark of its crooked trunk digging into the flesh of his back, plum-shaded apples hanging low beside the verdant leaves veiling his body from the sun, while he contemplates the meaning of life and reaches. Thank you.
Jim Harms has remarked that my poems are a testament to hope, and that may well be true. Similarly, I'd say Barrett Lipkin's work is a testament to faith. Faith in the everyday, faith in dumb luck, faith in fortune and misfortune, faith in the process that is poetry, and faith in poetry itself to speak to the beauty and heartbreak and weird humor of it all. Grief and bewilderment and gratitude come together in Barrett's work. No tricks, as you might say. As we remarked in workshop the other night, there's so much wisdom in Barrett's poems. Sometimes it sounds strange to start, but I urge you to keep listening. What you need to hear is contained there. Please welcome Barrett Lipkin.
Thank you, everyone. Thanks, Marianne, Jim, and Glenn in particular. And all you who I've worked with, all my peers, current and past, for your inspiration. thank you to my wife, who is the best poet in the family, and through a dedication to process has inspired me when perhaps I've lost faith, which I think inspiring someone is the greatest gift you can do. So thank you all for who has inspired me at any time, in any way. Okay. Thank you very much. The first one's called "I'm Looking for a General Contractor." I won't be wondering if boogie makes value. The stake sits in oil. I've agreed to cut things. It is pointless to decide between you and I who has wanted more things in the history of our able bodies. Mine has certainly smelled worse overall recently. Would you believe how close the loony is linked to the price of oil? I can guess many things, so can you. That is the worst part. If things get too lecherous at any one point, you'll clean the kitchen with rubber gloves. I'll be thinking of calling my Nana. Potatoes can be gone to again and again. I'm a sure bet to complain about a thing I put in my life. In the spring of 45, my grandfather flipped a 5-ton supply truck he was driving in Germany, holding Coca-Cola bottles. It was the war of occupation. His commander was drunk and made him hold out his hands. He went back and picked up the bottles. Spices go a long way. I sold and sent off 15 pounds of books to Kentucky and am waiting to see who will be the shining and most beautiful person to buy this tricycle. That was not a joke either. The tricycle thing is really, talk to me after a few minutes. This one's called "We Just Need to Get the Place Ready for Guests." Make history, and in doing so, I will never ever sniff my fingers. Sink my eyes, shinely fist sunlight. Who is better, a sleeping pile of fiber or a silent better, a most better better? If I am silent, you, so angry, again to rest there, will beg and again beg, again offend your day you could rest. A wife is always waiting. He sleeps, his head is held softly, an Iranian boy who... when a man parks his RV across town to sleep. This afternoon, the bed did not leave. I'd be remiss. Grind aluminum. Rotate the bulb. Eyes closed. I did not leave. The fissure tripped. What else, I wonder? That spring, my mother left this earth. This one's called "I Was Thinking About Elegy." It was autumn. It was autumn when the page unspooled its geese as ribbons. It was autumn from the window in the hall. It was autumn tracing S's through follow, through found. Each lung was once cut stone. Cardinals dropped junipers, one for each. What untouched quality? How many once fit inside the painterly mouth? S's shed feathers. Skyward and rigid were the angles of your room. And this last one I wrote on Tuesday during my last workshop class ever. So I'm going to end on that. So I'm just going to say thank you and goodbye to now, and I'll read the last poem, and then that'll be it. So thank you and goodbye. This is called "The General Theme is Longing, and There's Variation on Longing." You may find yourself peeling and eating an orange, or asking what he said, or showing undergrads how it's done, or asking if it's a really big plum, or asking if we're ready to go, or asking about our little somethings, or noting something you might have said, or noting you like a statement-to-statement move, or saying you had a little trouble getting in, or asking for someone to fix the porch so that we may vandalize the house more easily. You thought it carried on pretty well, or saying if it were yours, you'd make a list of three things very briefly, something in a more staccato rhythm, or asking a man about the tone of a thing to fix, a project, oh goody, another life lesson to learn, or asking if there was other material ever, or explaining the difference between lyric and narrative, and noting that lyric is just an utterance, a cry, or saying when I tell a story, it's to make others go away, or saying physical stories are simple when you are hungry, and that you don't trust story either, and saying it's a shock that people are ultimately themselves and finally unavailable in some profound way. Or noting that it's actively raining, and noting stepsisters are fielding questions about Mary as a character. It's like getting off a merry-go-round. You can feel the rhythm more fully when you get everything to stop.
Denton's thesis is a collection of stories entitled Women Gone Bad. I don't know when I've been so very fond of a title. At the successful conclusion of her thesis defense, I recommended that she immediately carry herself to a bar, and from there on to the tattoo parlor to have said title permanently inscribed on her person. Emily does not need such advice, for she knows already how to tell good stories of vibrant, colorful souls making the most of their lots in life. There is a rare brand of love and toughness both in these stories, sometimes all at once, as in this brief exchange when the narrator's grandmother finally gets a hold of her after a considerable lapse in communication. "It's been so long. I thought you were dead in a ditch," my grandmother said when I answered the phone. This was not an uncommon greeting from my grandmother. Love and toughness both, rare indeed. Please welcome Emily Denton.
Inspired by one of the coolest girls I know, actually, which was my little brother's best friend when she was a kid. It's called Headless Ghost. August Tripp was born on the day of her Uncle Hadley's funeral. Later, people would swear she was born at his funeral instead of at Preston Memorial Hospital. Some even claimed Myra Tripp had given birth while leaning against Hadley's coffin. Because of this, or because her birthday fell on the anniversary of the strangest funeral the town had ever seen, August felt inextricably linked to her uncle. And not since Wyland Jones had been killed almost 50 years before, shot 24 times in the chest, and buried as poked through as a pincushion, had the town been so fascinated by the death. It wasn't just that Hadley Dunbar killed himself. Strung up in his mother's second-story linen closet, or that his death was ruled by the police as a suicide of a suspicious nature. A 6-foot boy in a 5-foot closet. But that his mother, after having found him, hanging between the tablecloths and the guest towels, took the garden shears, cut him down, laid him in the hallway, and left him there. Her maid, Mrs. Standard, found him 2 days later when she came to clean. It was the smell that was the worst, Mrs. Standard said after the funeral. She relished her brief celebrity status as being the one who found him there. "For one for me," she insisted. "Who knows how long he was stayed there. thinking of the hallway. Everyone in town knew the details of Hadley's death. Such a year after would still be the source of great confusion, speculation, and debate. They knew that he had used the Paisley print guest sheets for news. They knew that the medical examiner and the county coroner determined that he had died of strangulation, not a broken neck. They knew that a professional cleaning service had to be brought in, and that the stench of the body, 3 days dead, had to be cleaned out of the house. The funeral was a lavish affair for a suicide. Many said it was to make up for the leaving of a body 3 days dead. His mother, Eleanor Dunbar, was shamed into mourning. She ordered 16 different types of roses, and to blanket the silk-lined coffin. It was all too much, really, for a boy everyone knew wasn't going to get into heaven. Hadley had always been strange, odd. And Eleanor was convinced that he had never fully recovered after his scarlet fever. After the funeral, the house filled up with mourners. People began to gather. From curiosity, more than respect. The end of the day had produced an entire party of onlookers, talking in the same dull and static amazement once found only in those caves where once sound gave way to words. They extended their condolences all over the house, hunting for the one room where denial, despair, and embarrassment had put somebody into it. A closet with a tiny roof. Letting their heels click out and constantly going up and down the stairs. Why did he do it? All the same small whisperings of their dresses and what did it look like? Hallie's older sister, Myra, was more annoyed by his timing than saddened by his death. She sweated through three different black dresses during the visitation, funeral, and wake. Her baby spun, kicked, and squirmed inside her stomach. As she stood beside Hadley's coffin, she pulled herself with a Preston's funeral home fan and tried to ward off the nausea brought on by the smell of 16 different types of roses. He couldn't have waited another week to hang himself, she thought, or until the baby was out. Or he could have at least waited another month until September, but it wouldn't be so stifling hot. Myra had just closed the door on the last nosy neighbor and was walking to the front hall picking up napkins, through plates and stray forks. When her water broke, the last black dress she had sweat through was ruined. When her mother's neighbor, Mrs. Blakely, drove Myra to the hospital, she made her sit on an old towel, so as not to ruin her car's upholstery. Myra was in labor for less than an hour. She didn't even have time to change out of her dress into a hospital gown before the baby, a girl, fell into the daughter's hands. She named her August, which she later regretted. It was the heat, she said to her husband when he frowned at the birth certificate. August was an ugly baby, and she grew into a plain child. She was moody, listless, and prone to sudden fits of rage. She was rude to her mother's friends, played tricks on her Sunday school teacher, and by the time she was 11 years old, she had been suspended from school 4 times for getting into fights and once for cutting off Elise Darby's hair, or Elise Darby's braid, excuse me. with a pair of scissors on the school bus. And she made her mother nervous and gave her father headaches. She was bossy and had trouble with new friends. The friends she did have were boys, and most of whom were younger than herself. Those boys adored her with a singular and fierce determination, especially Cam Williams, who lived next door to her, to August's grandmother, and only three houses down from her. He was the only one of the boys who had been invited to August's house for dinner. He was the only one who watched TV with her in her den, and the only one who had been inside her bedroom. When she made the neighborhood boys play Moby Dick, Cam got to be the whale. August played Ahab. When she made the bank of the Black River Gorge a deserted island, he was her man Friday. And when she loved the boys and reenactments of Civil War, he was lieutenant to her General Sherman. Camp followed her as they fought rebels, pillaged plantations, burned Atlanta, and limped from one end of town to the other, riddled with dysentery.
The workshop next year without Claire Fowler in it, since I had her teach about half this semester. She's about the best person in a workshop right now. So. Oops, what glasses did I need? The essays in Claire Fowler's thesis experiment successfully with a recursive structure in which several topoi make periodic returns and their resonance deepens. Tarot, basement apartments, a particular friend, some men, a silverfish, depression and its impedimenta, and most strikingly, Pluto, the planet, the god enthroned in hell, and the hell journeys we take here on the Earth's thin crust. I was working with Claire last summer during the run-up to New Horizons' flyby of Pluto. Her excitement was infectious, and then it happened, a metaphor getting more particular and more beautiful every day. Please welcome Claire Fowler.
Since very early childhood, I have had a recurring dream of a white room so bright it is dimensionless, boundaries of wall and ceiling bleached invisible. It is a nightmare, a preoccupation that bleeds into waking. I think it could be real, hidden under the opacity of matter. Awake, I imagine tearing away the black paper of the night sky. A wall of cold starlight stretches immense and glaring. At my feet, scraps of night. Or I scratch at the dark paint, freeing shreds of light. Outer space gathers under my fingernails like ink from a pen or blood from a scab. I feel I could even peel my body back, starting at the fingers of my right hand. What is left? White absence, a perfect silhouette cut out of my bed or bathtub, the patch of grass outside my apartment. No body, no crime. I prefer dreams of family death, faceless chasing men, crimes committed and forgotten, suicide. The white room is too stark, too static, almost violent in its silent, bright thrust. Immensity startles me. Oceans, miles of flat ice or prairie, a clear night, the size of creation. I read Philip Larkin. One shivers slightly looking up there. It is the shiver of nakedness. No walls or ceiling to limit, to secure. 3 years old. We live in a two-story house repurposed as two apartments at the top of a hill in poor suburban West Side Charleston. My mother, not yet 30, does not allow me to take apples from the next door neighbor who offers them rough and green from his tree. My father inspects fire extinguishers. During the day, I am left at home with my mother and our white cat. She will not return to work till I am close to 4 years old. I bang pots with wooden spoons, beg my mother to let me wash my doll's clothes in a bucket of soapy water. My favorite doll is Penny Pop, named by my father. She is missing one button eye. The loose thread hangs like an optic nerve. She came that way, found in a basket of stuffed animals at the Union Mission. The white cat likes me only at mealtimes. If my mother is in the next room, I let him jump on the table to nose my food. Rooms brighten and dim as clouds pass over the sun. During afternoon naps, I do not sleep, but watch the changing light of my bedroom. Up and behind our apartment, the hill plateaus into a field overgrown with weeds, teeming with black snakes. Thank you.
Novel writing is hard work. It takes time. Maggie Berenger now knows this well. And I applaud her for having so tirelessly put in that time to give us a wonderful book. One set largely in the South, both the old one and the supposedly new. The people with whom she populates her Tennessee are whiskey makers. And I wish to allow the opening lines of Maggie's novel, The Doddridge Distillery, to evoke this essence of time and age and making things well. So, from the prologue. Whiskey takes a long time to make well. The water, the grain, the yeast, the mash, the stills, the barrels, each piece must be the same each time the grain cooks and the yeast bubbles and the steam blows through the copper trays and the clear liquor meets the wood. It is lovely work. Please welcome Maggie Barron.
All right, Mom, you were right. The bun is a good idea. just a few thank yous. I'd like to thank everyone in the years, my year, in the years above me, and the years below me in this program who have been so kind and helpful with feedback to Glenn and Mark and even Kevin, wherever you are. thank you for the serious consideration of my work and all your help. And then also to Glenn, I'm sorry, to Marianne and Jim, for all your help behind the scenes. It is difficult to do thoughtful administrative work. Anybody who has done administrative work knows that, so we are very lucky to have them. And then finally, I'd like to thank my parents who, regardless of my age, regardless of whether I was leaving a full-time career or moving very far away, have always been supportive of me writing and getting this degree. She's waving in the back. So Mary was right, it's a little bit of a rowdy crowd this year, so I have a rowdy story to finish us up. As Glenn said, the novel that I started in this thesis is partly set in a whiskey distillery making family. So the Doddridges, and the scene that I'm about to read from is a party that the Doddridges are hosting at their house, and the speaker is Daniel Doddridge, the patriarch of the family, and he is telling a whiskey tale that I would like to tell to you. So this is him speaking. As I said, the federal agents, the ones from the Bureau of Prohibition, made a practice of roadside stops. They'd confiscate the shipment and usually beat up the boys making the run before hauling them off to jail. Here again, we got lucky. Daniel smiled. Katie Mae knew he had come to his favorite part of the story. Dayton and my daddy could always see a person, really know a man's character. They were friendly with everyone at the distillery, but they held the good ones tight. Later on in his life, Dayton took a shine to a kid named Charlie, who most people regarded as a little off. He didn't talk much, kept to himself. He was never mean-spirited, always polite, but a loner. He did, and this was what troubled most people, have a way with snakes. Daniel paused, closed his eyes for a moment, almost as if he was finding an image of the man. Charlie would walk through the woods with his hand held at his side, just level with his hip. He would look straight ahead and a little down at the ground. This was his way of seeing the color of a snake as it moved, the glint that caught its skin. When he saw one, he'd dip his hand, forming his fingers into a loose circle to slide under the snake's body and up to its head. The motion came full circle with Charlie holding a snake right at his chest. He'd usually stand still with the creature for a bit and either set it down or carry it right out of the woods. If he let it loose, he'd watch it move away and then keep walking. If he kept it with him, he'd carry the thing clear on to the next place he was going. Charlie wasn't religious. He never spoke in tongues, and he wasn't looking to hurt the animals, just held them. Sometimes around his arm, sometimes up against his chest, he seemed to feel comfortable with them, and the snakes didn't seem to be bothered. Now, Charlie wasn't a still man, and he wasn't much use in the rickyard, but he liked to drive the shipments, and customers liked that he didn't look to chat when he dropped off a crate or a pint. So Dayton gave him one of the larger routes. Of course, that meant that the young man usually brought a snake along. He was always the one to pick up the merchandise out of the truck. Most people didn't even know about his accompaniment. But about a year or two after Prohibition went into effect, my daddy had an idea about Charlie's habits and those federal agents. The next time David got wind of a stop planned on the Birmingham route, he sent Charlie and another boy, Pat, out with a truckload. They were stopped by two federal agents a mile or so over the border into Alabama on Route 431. Middle of nowhere. As one of them roughed up the boys, the other started rummaging around in the back, surveying the load. He's waving around his gun, one of those young bucks so eager to get a shot off. And what does he find but three cottonmouths, pissed as hell that he'd messed with their nest. Several people hooted with laughter. Katie Mae, who was not one for snake stories, shivered. Daniel chuckled. I'm sure y'all have all had a run-in with those snakes, and you know they can be nasty creatures when they want to be. We have a right to be scared of them. Now this agent, he wasn't bitten, but the whole sight spooked him so bad he dropped his gun, and in doing so, he shot himself in the pecker. Daniel nodded. That's a pleasant injury, and certainly one that stayed with him. It created enough of a commotion that Pat and Charlie got back on the road, and it was enough of a legend that Charlie and the other drivers never got too much hassle from the law. In fact, word got back to my daddy that the story going around the federal agents was that it was Charlie who shot the man in his pecker, that the men at Doddridge Distillery were crazy enough to do that. I guess the poor agent was too embarrassed to admit it was he himself who'd taken himself out of commission. Now, I won't say that we operated entirely uninterrupted for the rest of the Prohibition era, but more or less, we were left alone to keep making this wonderful piece of artistry. He held up his glass, and once again, as was the tradition at all Doddridge events, the crowd toasted the family and the man speaking. Thank you.
Our readers. Of course, you want to get some photos, so if you will come up to the front and if someone who really knows